The Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Stacey Lynn. Fighting has intensified in Gaza with Israeli troops attacking by ground and air.
The international pressure on Israel is mounting, with French President Emmanuel Macron calling on Israel to stop dropping bombs on Gaza, which kills babies and women. Prime Minister Netanyahu fired back at Macron, saying the responsibility for any harm to civilians lies with Hamas. The terror organization, he said, is using schools, mosques, and hospitals as terrorist command centers. You're Tom Confino for CBS News in Tel Aviv.
One of the highest-profile coaches in college football has been banned from the sidelines. Michigan's Jim Harbaugh is accused in a cheating scandal. Here's CBS's Errol Barnett.
Now, for his part, Coach Harbaugh has denied any knowledge of signal stealing, and the school says it intends to appeal this decision and fight back.
No word how it will impact the team's game today at Penn State. It's one of their biggest games of the year. The FBI has seized New York City Mayor Eric Adams' electronic devices. Details from CBS's Michelle Miller.
It's all part of an investigation into whether Adams' 2021 campaign conspired with the Turkish government to receive foreign donations funneled through straw donors. On Friday, Adams' attorney told CBS News that the mayor has not been accused of any wrongdoing and continues to cooperate with the investigation.
At the White House this morning, President Biden is hosting a reception for veterans and military members. He'll then head to a Veterans Day commemoration at Arlington National Cemetery, where he'll lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, then deliver remarks. Former President Trump wanted his classified documents trial postponed until after the presidential election, but a judge in Florida said no. CBS's Jeff Glor.
Trump's attorneys asked the judge to consider scheduling challenges from his three other pending criminal trials. His civil fraud trial is underway in New York now. U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon called the request a delay premature and ruled Friday that the trial will begin on May 20th, 2024, but she would reconsider the request again next March.
Our Michael George with details now on some tainted pet food.
The FDA is warning that seven people, mostly infants, have been infected with salmonella after coming into contact with pet food that's been recalled. The outbreak has been linked to numerous brands of dry dog and cat food made by Mid-America Pet Food of Texas.
In Iceland, a town near the capital evacuated overnight. Authorities say about 4,000 people rushed out after hundreds of tremors caused a lot of fears of a volcanic eruption. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credit.
If you're the Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin, it's your hometown radio, refreshed.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
This is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. A new study reveals how bad toxic chemicals are for brain development in kids. More from Eric Galatis.
Children of color and from low-income families are not only exposed to more dangerous toxic chemicals, including lead, tailpipe, and other air pollution, plastics, and pesticides, they also experience disproportionate harm to brain development compared to their white and higher-income peers, according to a new report. Co-author Devin Payne Sturges says 5 decades of data shows that poverty exacerbates these impacts.
The combined experience, say, of exposure to lead in the environment and being from an impoverished community or a low-income family actually worsened the negative cognitive impacts.
Americans of all ages are exposed to some level of toxins, but children whose brains are damaged by these chemicals find it harder to concentrate in class, to recall lessons learned, and are more likely to fail and repeat grades. Payne Sturges says that communities of color are not simply making bad decisions about where to raise families. Unhealthy environments are a result of decisions made by industry leaders and government policies.
And and has a long history related to discriminatory practices, residential segregation that forced people only to live in certain places that often happened to be places where polluting industries would site.
Payne Sturgis says interventions such as replacing lead pipes that bring drinking water into homes are important, but she says policies are needed at the national level to address the cumulative public health impacts. This is Eric Galatis. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some sprinkles or light rain showers. We'll see a high around 42. For tonight, chance of rain, mostly cloudy, lows around 38. Gradually becoming sunny on your Sunday with highs in the mid-50s. For Monday, look for sunshine and a high around 52. That's weather.
It's 39 at our studios.
On air, 93.5 FM. Online, thetap.com. And on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome to this, our second hour. Our second hour of the broadcast focusing on law and government, the aspiration for justice in America. It is Veterans Day 2023. It is 105 years since Armistice Day 1918. We pensively, reflectively recall that time in our world history. And we celebrate the incredible contributions made by our veterans living today to our safety and security domestically and worldwide. We remember as well those many who have lost their lives in preservation of our own safety and security. That not just on Memorial Day, but should be every day of the year, including this Veterans Day 2023. We are talking about our safety and security this morning in our first and now our second hour, related to all of these developments, the legal developments, the rule of law developments, the government developments when it comes to guns in America, and in particular, the impact of Bruin decided about 15, 16 months ago that calls back history and says, in order to justify current restrictions on the use, the transfer, the manufacture, the movement of weapons, of firearms in our nation, you got to be able to identify something in history that supports that. And we're getting these different views out there from judges on what should and should not be the implications of Bruin. And in particular, this oral argument before the Supreme Court just on Tuesday, almost certainly finding that the federal law that prohibits an individual who is subject to a domestic violence restraining order cannot, should not be in possession of a weapon. That's almost certainly going to be their decision. We also have some terrific listeners who are calling in, texting in this morning about this all-important issue. And I want to acknowledge specially that Angie has texted Anya and me. She talks about the fact that she's working. She says she wishes she could call in. We do too. But Angie, we so appreciate your particular comment, your text to me, your comment. She said, I know of a jurisdiction out there in the Midwest in which they have changed their laws because of Bruin, because of this focus on history, where, according to Angie again, you don't even need the permission of parents, as we saw in Highland Park there, anymore to own a firearm. And again, that's, Angie, you're spot on. That's the kind of thing that legislatures around the country, local legislatures, state, and yes, in other areas, even rulemakers, are invoking Bruin to say that these previous limitations, if they do not have what Clarence Thomas identified as this historical antecedent, this precursor in history, therefore they're not constitutional. We appreciate very much that observation, Angie, others as well. And we've got also Joe on the line. Joe calling in this morning from Madison. Always appreciate your comments and questions, Joe, this morning on our broadcast.
Thanks, Jim. It's always great. It's a fascinating subject, and I'm happy to have the chance to add my 2 cents. And those 2 cents are that when Judge Thomas put forth this idea in Bruin that there had to be, rather than competing interests, instead we look to history, what was happening at the time of the Founding Fathers, to decide these Supreme Court cases. One thing I would throw into the mix here, which I find sad and ironic, Judge Thomas, an African-American man, is talking about history at that time. At the time of our Founding Fathers, Black people were not allowed to have guns. There was a great worry on the part of slave owners about slave revolts. And in fact, in our country, we've had over 270 slave revolts. And they also had the example of Haiti, where there was a slave revolt that was hugely successful. The slaves overtook their slave owners. So given that, the access that Black people, even Black freemen could have to guns was terribly, horribly restricted and didn't exist at all, I find it really, really sick and ironic that this man looks to history rather than competing interests. Because if you look to history, it tells a very different story.
Absolutely.
Thanks. I would appreciate your thoughts on this, Jim.
Joe, as always, thoughtful comments. And yes, Joe, appropriately saying, all right, Supreme Court, if that is the standard, as strange and peculiar as it is, we look to history, we're not going to find that kind of consistent history in the past, right, Joe? That's your important reference point, the things that you've identified, the slave revolts, the other revolts of the past, the intersection between communities of men and women and firearms. All of those things may suggest just the opposite of what the Supreme Court is presently seemingly advocating for, certainly in terms of Heller and Bruin. Important to identify, as you said, the incongruities, the inconsistencies in our own Supreme Court justices. And yes, indeed, that's one of the reasons for the Supreme Court being on the receiving end of an awful lot of criticism these days. And this history, this focus on history, is not, as we know well, just about firearms. We saw, Joe, and you and others have commented upon this on our broadcast, this whole refocusing on privacy rights in America. The decision by the Supreme Court, again in previous term, to overrule reproductive rights under the Constitution, no longer finding that abortion is a constitutionally protected right. What is that fundamentally premised upon? It's premised upon history, once again, looking backwards and trying to find, if you can, Supreme Court, from my view, I suspect in many other views, not being able to find an historical precedent for exactly what they're doing, but focusing upon history as a basis for determining that indeed under the Constitution there is not that right, coming to a result based upon backward-looking analysis instead of analyzing, as Joe, you underscored once again, what has been the approach when it comes to most legislation in America, which is you identify what the goal is. What is the purpose behind privacy rights litigation, legislation, constitutional provisions? And the purpose usually is beneficial, right? The government out there, whether it's local or state or federal, trying to ensure that we are safe and secure, trying to ensure that our well-being, as the Constitution says in its first lines, our safety and security, the well-being of our population is protected, and then determining as a second part of that analysis whether or not the thing that the legislature has put in place meets that end. Is it naturally it connected to that important goal? That's always been the analysis. And under those analyses, of course, these kinds of laws, whether they are related to privacy rights, whether they're related to firearms rights, other things in the Constitution, are upheld, right? And they are supported by that sort of rational analysis that Joe, you identified this morning, also identifying the inconsistency with respect to at least one of our Supreme Court justices when it comes to this bad history. And in that context, following up on Joe's good comment, and also the comment made by Angie about the implications of Bruin, it is significant that just this past week as well, the Wall Street Journal, in a major piece written by Jack Rakove, the headline is "The Justices Are Bad Gun Historians." The subheadline, consistent with what we've heard up to this point, "The Supreme Court's recent rulings," this from the Wall Street Journal, "Supreme Court's recent rulings on gun rights play fast and loose with the country's traditions of owning and regulating firearms." That's not me talking. That's not Angie talking. That's not Joe talking. That's the Wall Street Journal talking. Again, consistent with this notion that if you look to history, you're not going to find the premise, the predicate for doing what you're doing. Appreciate so much those good comments from Joe, from Angie. And also we've got Jack calling in from Merrimack this morning. Jack, would appreciate your comment or question this morning as a part of our discussion.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
It seems to me that about this Supreme Court and for actually decades now, the Supreme Court has ignored, while attempting to so-called uphold the Second Amendment, they've ignored three, and I think they're relatively important words in the Second Amendment. And those one of those words is militia. And not one of the plaintiffs in these cases that I've ever heard of has been a member of a legitimate government-authorized militia. And they've also ignored two other important words, which is well-regulated. Right. And they seem to be doing just the opposite. They seem to be deregulating everything. Going back to historical precedent, and going back to the their historical precedent, the court in the past has generally tried to take into account the progress that we've made, technical and social, right, since the founding fathers. And this court it's got six Federalist Society members, and their organization, the avowed purpose is to drive our laws and our ideas back into about the 1800s, maybe even earlier, with their so-called originalist interpretation of the Constitution.
Absolutely. Jack, I could not agree more, and I suspect many, not all, of our listeners will agree with that, but I certainly do. And let's take a look once again what the Second Amendment says. Those words that you talked about, Jack, most appropriately. Second Amendment says this, a well-regulated militia. That's your point. When a well-regulated regulation is right in the Constitution, militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The security of a free state, again, that's the goal of government, right? Keeping us safe and secure. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Again, an awful lot of people in our history and in our contemporary life look at that and say, yes, that is exactly, Jack, as you have interpreted, understood it, to mean that we've got a right. We've got a right to bear arms. When you've got a well-regulated militia, obviously our authors of that Second Amendment way back in 1791, ratified by the states and proposed initially by the Congress, they were concerned about the Brits coming back, right? And the capacity to put together that militia, which would defend our young nation at that time. Significantly, Jack, to your good point, throughout our history, until the time of Heller, 2008, under the authorship of Antonin Scalia, the Supreme Court, when it looked at the very language, those three words, those other two words you identified, Jack, has always interpreted exactly as you have this morning. And has always said that, yes, it has to do with a militia. It does not have to do with personal ownership of gun rights, not rights to carry weapons in public, absent this well-regulated militia. And that this history, the history, again, as the Wall Street Journal itself has said just this past week, is based upon bad history. Supreme Court's recent rulings play fast and loose with the country's tradition of owning and regulating firearms. That is what we are facing today. We'll anticipate that maybe the Supreme Court will pull back on that somewhat when it issues its opinion in Rahimi. It's got these other cases coming up from the Seventh Circuit, Fifth Circuit, some other cases also out there, also percolating up through the system. We'll talk about those down the road that could further define what the Second Amendment means in America in 2023 and beyond. Right after this break, we're going to talk more about justice in America in our courts, specifically in New York City. Stay with us for that discussion.
The Tap.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy.
Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
UpUS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
We are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast about justice in America. We're talking now about the proceedings that continue in the state court in Manhattan. This is the fraud trial against the Trump Corporation. Donald Trump himself, his two sons, and others involved with the Trump Organization, brought by the Attorney General of the state of New York, her name is Letitia James, alleging misrepresentations, fraud, misstatements in various documents under state law, prohibited by state law from falsifying those records when it comes to the valuations of properties, overstating properties for the purposes of obtaining loans, understating them for the purposes of taxes, misrepresenting under state law what those properties are valued at. And so you all know well that this past week we saw the testimony, again, as a part of the prosecution case. This is going to be part of our little law school here this morning on our broadcast. The prosecution case calling Donald Trump, and then also calling this past week his daughter, Ivanka. We're going to chat very briefly about that and give you some sense about what's going to happen this coming week as now this trial moves into the defense stage. And that may come as a surprise to some out there because you might think, well, gee, Donald Trump and his sons, who are all defendants in this case, have already testified. Here's the law school piece on this, and that is they were called as a part of this civil litigation, not a criminal case, called by the prosecution. Why? Well, in case of Ivanka Trump, she was there again just recently, in many ways to get into the record, many of the documents that were not previously introduced by other witnesses. Always important to have a witness on the stand who can say, yes, indeed, that is an email with which I'm familiar. That's a document that I know about. And sure enough, during the course of her testimony, just these past couple of days, much of the examination of Ivanka Trump, called by the prosecution, focused on their financing by Deutsche Bank of loans for the Florida golf resort and a spa. And those were allegedly premised upon false statements about the Trump Organization net worth. And so, for example, Ivanka Trump seemed to recognize the terms of some of those loans that are out there as being almost too good to be true, because she said in an internal Trump Organization email presented during the course of her testimony during this trial itself in December of 2011, that it doesn't get much better than this. That's what she wrote. Now, she acknowledged during the course of her testimony that her recollection, not always good. And many of these things, yes, and many years passed, repeatedly saying, I don't recall, I don't remember. But she also testified that even though the particular documents, not all of them, refreshed her memory about what happened, the documents are still coming in. And this is fundamentally a documents case. It's a case being presented by the prosecution supporting this notion of fraud, supporting the notion that these particular defendants intended to engage in the fraud that's identified in this trial, supporting the notion that in the end, there should be significant civil penalties. Letitia James seeking about $250 million for the offenses committed by the Trump Organization, allegedly, in this civil case. Ivanka Trump testifying that those materials didn't always refresh her memory, couldn't always recall, but agreeing that the terms offered by some of these banks were in fact favorable, and also that others internal to the Trump Organization acknowledge those kinds of things. And so in many ways, the testimony of Ivanka Trump, while maybe not advancing materially the prosecution case, permits the prosecution to get even more documents in before the trier of fact And here it is, Arthur Engoron, who's the judge who's presiding. He's the one who's going to make the decision about what happens here, getting even more documents to support this notion that people inside the Trump organization understood what was going on, knew what was happening, and that these documents support that conclusion. Donald Trump, early in the week, also testifying for a couple of days. His testimony, also the source of a lot of reporting out there. You have seen it as well. Really falls in two categories. The legitimate portion of the testimony, the arguably helpful portion that goes to issues related to things before the judge right now. That is whether he intended, whether he knew, whether he had exposure to these fraudulent statements along the way. In a number of instances, he unwittingly perhaps said that, yes, indeed, I was aware I was involved in this process that resulted in this particular valuation. He identified a document or two or three or more that confirmed his involvement in this very process. That's the intent portion that the prosecution has to establish, even as Donald Trump is indicating that, yes, as the chief executive officer, the guy in charge, he understood that this was a part of his duty and responsibility, acknowledged that a key portion of the government's case to establish that intent, that connection between the fraud and this particular defendant. The second portion, perhaps even the major portion of his testimony, of course, the kind of thing that was getting Judge Engoron very, very upset, at some point calling upon, that is Judge Engoron calling upon Trump's attorneys, saying this, can you please control your client, he said from the bench. This is not a political rally. We'll be here forever, the judge said, and we'll accomplish nothing. Very frustrated. And again, all this taking place while quite literally Judge Engoron and Donald Trump, former president of the United States of America, now defendant in this case, are sitting perhaps closer than Anya and I are sitting right now in the studios here of Civic Media, probably 2 or 3 feet apart. And along the way, Donald Trump, during the course of his testimony this past week, says the judge, who again is right there next to him, called me a fraud and he doesn't know anything about me. Now, that's a reference by Donald Trump, accurately, to the decision by Judge Engoron prior to the trial that on a summary judgment motion, he found fraud. He said there's no doubt that the facts of this case support fraud. The documents show that. And again, he has this trial to establish the connection between that fraud and what these particular defendants knew, what they intended. That includes, of course, the sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric. They also testified in the previous weeks as we talked in our last broadcast. Along the way, Donald Trump, of course, also says other things inappropriate, that they do not move forward the findings of fact that have to be made here. Nothing substantive about them. He calls the attorney general who's prosecuting the case a political hack. He calls this a very unfair trial. And all of this, again, happening, yes, outside of the courtroom, but also while he's a witness on the stand. Wildly inappropriate. No other defendant would be permitted even to go down this road. He does say along the way, the net worth of me was far greater than these financial statements indicate. And then goes on to say, people go around and try to demean me and try to hurt me. Well, it may not be about hurting or demeaning, but it does mean that the prosecution is intending to show that you engaged in a civil violation of the law. That's what this case is all about, Mr. Trump. And that's the reason why, again, as a part of the process here, here's your civil procedure on our morning broadcast this coming week, you, Donald Trump, and the Trump other players, the organization itself has an opportunity now to present its case. And indeed, many of these same defendants may be recalled next week. We may see them again. We know, for example, on Monday of this week that Donald Trump Jr. will be back on the stand as a part of the defense case, presumably under questioning by the attorneys for the corporation, by the attorneys for the Trumps themselves, trying to establish that indeed the things that were established these past couple of weeks are not in fact to be believed by the trier of fact, Judge Engoron. And that indeed presumably be a part of the presentation. An awful lot of people, me included, believe that as a part of this presentation this coming week, the defense will try to distance itself from these documents and talk more generally about the lack of intent and purpose by the players in this. When we come back right after this brief suspension of our good discussion here this morning, we're going to talk more about that case and then also talk about some other defendants who are out there and their bar-related and other litigation woes here on our morning broadcast.
Borderline tonight. Tonight, too bad, but it's the life you lead. You're so ahead of yourself that you forgot what you need. Though you could see when you're wrong, you know you can't always see when you're right.
Step on up and enjoy what's on tap today. Local talk about the Valley and all of Wisconsin. In fact, it's on tap every day. This is 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief. Criticism is rising against Israel over its bombing near hospitals in Gaza. French President Macron is among those speaking out.
De facto, today, civilians are bombed. De facto, these babies, these ladies, these old people are bombed and killed. There is no reason for that.
The Big Ten Conference has banned University of Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh for the season over a scouting scandal. Reporter Erica Herskowitz.
The Big Ten found the school was in violation of carrying out in-person scouting of its opponents for several years, which the conference says gave Michigan an unfair competitive advantage.
The FBI has seized electronic devices belonging to New York City Mayor Eric Adams over a probe into campaign fundraising. Former U.S. Attorney Zachary Carter.
You're going to find evidence of when calls were made or received, and who made or received those calls.
CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The last time the Packers won a game in Pittsburgh was over 50 years ago, December 1970. Bart Starr still the quarterback. The Steelers had a rookie quarterback out of LSU who only completed 3 of 20 passes and 4 interceptions. His name? Terry Bradshaw. Today, the Steelers quarterback is from Pitt, Kenny Pickett, who talked about the Packers' defense.
They're really strong up front. They got, I think, you know, it all starts in the trenches. I think they got a great, you know, front four. They do some different things. Their linebackers are really aggressive, run well. Some veteran safeties that make a lot of plays on the ball, and some of their zone coverage have some really good instincts for the ball.
Packers quarterback Jordan Love says he'll have to keep an eye on the Steelers linebacker, T.J. Watt, from Wisconsin.
T.J.'s a great player, plays with, like, really good effort on every play, and I think their whole defense does a good job of that. So we got to be able to match that.
That's Jordan Love. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Did you know this local radio station is part of Civic Media? Learn more about the entire network at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some sprinkles or light rain showers. We'll see a high around 42. For tonight, chance of rain, mostly cloudy, lows around 38. Gradually becoming sunny on your Sunday with highs in the mid-50s. For Monday, look for sunshine and a high around 52. That's weather.
It's 39 at our studios.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes, don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Earl Ingram.
If all the other things globally aren't enough to give us pause, healthcare premiums rose 8% this year. And so corporations are starting to feel the strain of offering health care to their employees, and more of them are abdicating that. What are people to do?
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. 93.5 The Tap. From Lake Wissota State Park and the Pablo Center, the entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown. 93.5, The Tap. UK.
Welcome back this morning, Saturday, November 11th, Veterans Day 2023, to our discussion in these final periods. Next half hour, lots of time to talk about what's going on in the New York State Court. And again, here is your bit of legal education this morning. At the time that the government rested, at the time Letitia James said, I presented all my evidence, all the documents we talked about, all of that showing in the view of the state that indeed there was the fraud that the judge has already found pursuant to his summary judgment motion prior to the trial, his granting that motion, finding that as a matter of fact and law, the fraud is existing. And now the government, having rested in its case, presenting evidence of the connection between the fraud that the judge found and these particular defendants, the witnesses who are on the stand, and all the documents further giving some cement, if you will, to this finding about fraud. What happened is, appropriately, under the federal rules and the federal process here, and the state process as well, the defense offered to the judge what's called a motion for a directed verdict. And that happened yesterday. At the result of the presentation of all of this, the defense taking the position that all of this evidence does not, in fact, support the position taken by the government, by the state, in its initial complaint, by presentation made during the course of these last several weeks. And as a matter of law, judge, this the argument being offered by the defense counsel, you should enter a verdict, a directed verdict, it's what's called under civil procedure, finding that the government has failed to prove its case and shutting this down. Basically finding that there is no there, and that the case should now be resolved in favor of the defense because the government has failed to shoulder its support, its burden of proof in this matter, which again is a preponderance, just a little more than 50% of the evidence, failed to support that burden of proof and therefore grant a directed verdict finding in favor of the defendant. Well, the judge, Justice Engoron here, that's what the judges are called there at the trial courts, has taken that under advisement, not because he's going to grant that motion. That, too, is fairly routine. The judge will take that under advisement and probably resolve that at the end of the forthcoming case by the defense as well. Almost certainly going to deny it. There is more than compelling evidence to support a preponderance finding of the fraud that Letitia James has alleged here. And will now be entertaining the further presentation of defense witnesses, including Donald Trump Jr., others presumably in the Trump organization. We're also going to get a lot of testimony probably in the coming week from bank representatives, presumably supporting part of the allegation, part of the defense in this case, banks not harmed. Banks no longer on the receiving end of any fraud here because they suffer no financial loss. That, in any event, which may not be true, but nonetheless, that's the argument being made by the defense attorney. So we're going to get a lot of financial representatives from the banks about the nature of the misrepresentation, if any, made to them, and the consequences of that, financial or otherwise. All that's going to be a part of the trial continuing now in the defense stage. At the end of this entire process, obviously the prosecution has an opportunity to make what's called a closing argument, summarizing everything that the judge here, the trier of fact, has seen, has heard, has digested, including the documents, including the oral testimony. The defense, likewise, has an opportunity, similarly in our process, to make a closing argument. They will do that after the conclusion of all this testimony. Along the way, even before that happens, if the government decides that it wants to present what's called a rebuttal case in this prosecution, it can do so. May well be that Letitia James will choose to recall Ellen Weisselberg. Ellen Weisselberg, the CFO, previously convicted in a federal case, who also testified earlier in this case, again, as a part of that prosecution presentation. His testimony interrupted while they went back and looked at whether or not some of the documents in this case supported or failed to support what he was saying in trial. Likely that Letitia James, even before her closing argument, may well recall Ellen Weisselberg to testify again. All of that coming up in a trial likely to last, yes, that's right, into December. We've got several weeks yet to go in all of this. More of that coming up. We'll continue to monitor all this. And presumably, ultimately, if not at the end of the trial, presumably Judge Engoron going to issue what I would anticipate to being a multi-page, many, many pages of description of what he finds, so that when this case is appealed, and it certainly will be appealed, presumably by the defense, to the appeals court in New York State, a state appeals court, there's a full and abundant record upon which the appeals court can review what has been done over these past several months. A lot to take in. It is a lot to take in. Nonetheless, important to understand the procedural history here and the procedure going forward under the basic rules of civil litigation. We know as well that those criminal cases continue to proceed apace. We've had some news out of South Florida. We've had some news out of the District of Columbia on those criminal cases as well. We'll talk about those down the road. This case pending in New York, again, it's a civil proceeding, no one going to jail, no one going to prison, the possibilities of fines, and the ultimate reason why this civil case is so important. I hesitate to say it is more important than the criminal cases. That's an assessment that history will make. But this case, hugely important. Why? Because it has the potential to shut down the Trump Corporation itself. The judge has already basically withdrawn the certificates under New York law that permit it to operate and its operation going forward. The question is, what does that mean in the future? Will the Trump Organization continue to exist at all? Will there be a receivership appointed? Will there be a special master in some way appointed to administer the assets and the operations of the organization? That also could very much be a part of Judge Engoron's ultimate decision in this case, which we will follow and we will talk about in future broadcasts. As an aside, some of you in the past have asked about what happens with some of these attorneys who are also the subject of criminal prosecutions out there, unindicted co-conspirators, and also indicted co-conspirators related to January 6th. Again, a different set of allegations in the state of Georgia. Well, we know from just this past week, two of those attorneys, John Eastman and also Rudy Giuliani, much in the news. We can be fairly brief about these because the news is brief, but it is significant. This is over and apart from what's going on with respect to them and co-defendants in those criminal cases. But just this past week, John Eastman, who is licensed in the state of California, in the wake of quite literally weeks and months of proceedings before the state bar there, determining whether or not, because of his misrepresentations about the 2020 election, and yes, indeed, the things that he said in putting together these illegal mechanisms for attempting to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Again, John Eastman being the architect, along with this guy named Ken Chesbro, also a lawyer, of the basic mechanisms presented to Donald Trump and others to try to stop Joe Biden from taking the Oval Office. The California bar, just this past week, through a judge named Yvette Rowland, found that John Eastman was in fact culpable for multiple ethics violations under the state of California. That's where he's licensed. And as a result of that, the prosecutors in that administrative matter attacking whether or not and finding whether or not proposing that John Eastman not be permitted to continue to practice law in the state of California, giving them the basis to present even more evidence in support of either the suspension of his license or his complete disbarment. That going forward in the state of California, ultimately probably after a finding of either disbarment or suspension, that ending up in front of the California Supreme Court. Likewise, in the District of Columbia, the same thing happening, very similar with respect to Rudy Giuliani. Again, a former U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York many years ago, former mayor of the city of New York, also fighting disbarment recommendations in the District of Columbia based upon a report finding professional misconduct of his, same kind of thing, his misrepresentations about the 2020 election and his attempts through the former president and others to try to overturn the legitimate results of that election. Here's what the District of Columbia bar basically said. The report said just this past week, he claimed massive election fraud, but had no evidence of it. By prosecuting this destructive case, again, this is written by the District of Columbia bar officials, Mr. Giuliani, a sworn officer of the court, forfeited his right to practice law. And a New York state court, again, like the D.C. court here,
this finding of disbarment, a recommendation being made. A New York state court has also previously gone down the same route, also suspending his law license there. All of this, plainly not good news for Rudy Giuliani in connection with his licensing to practice law in the District of Columbia, his license to practice law in New York, and virtually all of the other attorneys that we've spoken about, including the Ken Chesbros of the world, the Jenna Ellises of the world, indeed, the Sidney Powells of the world, all these other lawyers who made these representations also going to be facing bar disciplinary proceedings in those jurisdictions in which they are licensed to practice law. Important to note that this is, again, these are not criminal proceedings. They are civil only in the nature that they are administrative with respect to your license to practice law in these jurisdictions. They don't traditionally involve the imposition of fines unless there's some restitution that needs to be paid to clients. But they do, in fact, they could, in fact, be effectively, as some people have said, the death penalty for purposes of the capacity to be a lawyer. And that's why those matters pending in California, in New York, and yes, in District of Columbia are so very important as we think about all the things coming out of the January 6th of 2021 insurrection and the attempt to overthrow the government, the attempt to undermine and stop the counting of votes on that day. In that connection, a couple of other brief snapshots of things that have happened just this past week. We know that as a result of the single most significant, largest investigation ever undertaken by our federal Justice Department, including the FBI, a part of the U.S. Department of Justice, the single largest investigative and prosecutorial initiative ever in our history. Up to this point, approximately 1,200 people have been convicted and have been sentenced and charged previous to those events in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia. 1,200 people. And among those, every single week, there are more individuals who are charged based upon the investigative work of the FBI and other officials, other law enforcement authorities, who are pleading guilty in many cases, some of them going to trial. There have been a couple of small dismissals entered by the district court judges here in District of Columbia, but the overwhelming majority of these folks being found guilty after trials, most often being found guilty after pleading guilty in the federal court there. Just this past week, two cases, again, illustrative of the kinds of things happening. One of them involving a young man named Brandon Dillard. He pled guilty just this past week to a misdemeanor count of disorderly and disruptive conduct in some restricted areas on the Capitol grounds. He admitted to making physical contact with one of the officers, repeatedly grabbing his helmet. He acknowledged climbing the side of the building, and indeed, if you look online, you can see the pictures of him climbing the side of the Capitol building. He'll be sentenced down the road. His sentencing guidelines range is between 18 and 14 months imprisonment for doing just that. Certainly among all the defendants who have been convicted and charged, probably at the lower end. Some people have gotten probation. Others, as we know, Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, 18 and 22 years imprisonment. Some of those sentences now being appealed, believe it or not, by the Justice Department, saying that that's not enough. In this particular case, Brandon Dillard facing 18 to 14 months imprisonment. We'll see what a district court judge in his case. Online, significantly, people following these cases have identified him as the spider Nazi. Again, perhaps including an awful lot of people looking at his garb, because while he was doing this, he was wearing a distinctive spider web patterned hooded sweatshirt. And you've got some pictures of him presumably attempting to be a Spider-Man, a spider climbing up the side of the Capitol, an attempt to be perhaps somewhat frivolous in the midst of a very serious piece of conduct here, resulting in his criminal conduct and a misdemeanor violation, disorderly conduct, disruptive conduct on that day. We also know just this past week that even perhaps more seriously than that, the sentencing of a defendant who did go to trial receiving a sentence of 70 months imprisonment. When we come back right after this brief break, we're going to talk about what that former State Department official and former Marine Corps veteran received in the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. Sentimental, your best bet's true, baby blue continental. Hot funk, cool punk, even if it's old junk, still rock and roll.
listening to 93.5 The Tap. Earl Ingram.
Clearly, at this point, what is going on in Congress and the importance of the Speaker, that's always been a high-profile position, Sandy. Why can't we get that fixed?
The problem really comes down to the problem we have within the parties. Not only are we highly polarized between parties, but we seem to be highly polarized within party as well.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station. 93.5 The Tap.
We are back talking this morning, Veterans Day 2023, about a couple of these additional sentences imposed upon defendants identified, investigated, and prosecuted by the U.S. Department of Justice for their involvement in the January 6th riot, the insurrection of that day. Federico Klein, sentenced to 70 months. That's nearly 6 years in federal prison. No parole in federal prison these days, by federal judge Trevor McFadden. He was also fined $3,000, ordered to pay restitution of $2,000, probably based upon the destruction of some property. What did Federico Klein do on January 6th? He engaged in some of the most violent conduct of that day, including some repeated attacks on the police. He was urging other rioters at the time to join that fight that he himself was engaged in. He was attempting to prevent some of the officers from closing some doors. Indeed, some of the most aggressive and violent behavior perpetrated by him. You can see some of those videos and those images online. And significantly, Federico Klein, again, not receiving the longest sentence, but certainly not the shortest sentence, nearly 6 years in federal prison for doing all of that, again, at the hand of his own intent. As an employee of the federal government, former State Department official Federico Klein, the prosecutor at the time of the sentencing, says this: because he was a federal employee in the United States Department of State, he was endowed with the trust of the American people and to uphold the law. This is what the prosecutor said to the sentencing judge. He violated that trust when he attacked the very country for which he was paid to work. Federico Klein, a former State Department official attacking the United States Capitol, attacking our democracy, our republic on January 6th, also a former Marine Corps member, a veteran of the Marine Corps, going away to jail now for nearly 6 years for his involvement in that activity on that day. This is a week in which we also saw, pursuant to the regular processes and procedures of a grand jury, the return of an indictment against 60 defendants in New York. The Gambino Mafia family indicted on arrest in New York based on charges of violent extortion, assault, union-related crimes, part of the La Cosa Nostra families. The reason I bring it up is because that kind of conduct is also presumably not only going on in New York, but throughout our nation. Grand juries across our country hearing evidence of crime presented by federal and state and sometimes even local authorities and determining whether or not there's probable cause to find that an indictment should issue. In this case, coming out of Brooklyn, these 16 different defendants charged with violations of federal law, assault, arson, union-related crimes having to do with the demolition industry there in Brooklyn. A mafia family crackdown. Again, very serious. All of this, of course, human tragedy, not only for the victims, but also for everyone involved in these prosecutions along the way, identified in this indictment among the 16, our family captain, Joe Brooklyn. That's how he's identified in part
in the indictment. Others called Diego Danny, another one called Uncle Cicio, another one called Vinny Slick, another one called Twin, and finally one of them called Fifi. All of those people identified in the grand jury indictment by their common names, that not properly disclosing fully the nature of their criminal conduct. Along the way, attached to the indictment is a photograph of a baseball bat, presumably used by these members of the Gambino Mafia family, now charged with these federal offenses, indicted, arrested, in custody in New York, a bat used to effectuate their union-related crimes as a part of their extortion, their assault, and their arson. As we begin to close out our discussion here on Veterans Day 2023, we're also very much mindful of the fact that our veterans, living and dead, fought in our nation for the integrity of our government and the conduct of our government. We are very much aware of the fact that as we gather today on Saturday, November 11th, on this Veterans Day, that our Congress, our government in Washington, D.C., has a whopping 6 days to once again put together a budget for the United States operation of our government. Let's talk about the predicates for that. The United States Constitution, James Madison, George Mason, the creators of our nation, established in Article 1, Section 8, that the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. Section 9 of Article 1, which is the legislative piece in our Constitution, provides that no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. That's the constitutional predicate for what the Congress is obliged to do by virtue of the fact that we send them to our nation's capital to put in place a budget. Very clear that the House initiates these federal spending and taxation processes for the budget, for appropriations, and then sends those proposals to the House, to the Senate from the House. The Constitution provides the basis for that, but there's a thing called the Budget and Accounting Act of 1921 that establishes the statutory basis for an executive budget, requiring the president to present that. That's been done. There's a thing called the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act of 1974 that establishes the trappings of this congressional budget process, provides for the annual adoption of a resolution of the budget and a mechanism for facilitating all this decision-making that has to happen right now. It also establishes along the way the House and Senate budget committees who are charged by us through the Constitution, by us as the constituents in our nation, creating the Congressional Budget Office as well to provide budgetary information to that Congress responsible for putting together a budget independent of the executive branch. The Constitution requires this action be undertaken. These statutory authorities of 1921, of 1974, also provide the trappings of how this is supposed to happen. We have not had in our nation an actual budget for over two decades. We have had continuing resolutions. We've had the operations of government permit to go forward based upon decisions by piecemeal kicking the can down the street from time to time. And that's what we have going on right now. In 6 days from now, as a result of the latest deal that was put in place not too long ago, the Congress is obliged within 6 days by next Friday to implicate, to invoke all of these things and establish a budget. Time to send the message to our Congress, to all those representatives, that it's time to put a budget in place and not continue to do this, not only because of the integrity of our nation, the Constitution, but in memory of the reason for our veterans on this Veterans Day, their service, their important contributions to who we are as these United States of America. Join us again next Saturday for more discussion of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for joining me this day. And again, a pensive, thoughtful, and reflective Veterans Day 2023. I got bills to pay and children who need clothes. I know there's fish out there, but where God only knows. They say these waters are in what they... Tell a friend what's on tap. There's a new station in town with conversation about Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley. This is 93.5 The Tap. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
The Todd Alba Show.
I had tweeted out after the second game of the year, a hot take. I said, by the end of the year, we will see Braden Locke as the starting quarterback of the Wisconsin Badgers. Now, Mr. Mordecai broke his hand. And by golly, not the way I thought it would happen, but Braden Locke has become the starting quarterback.
And another finger on the monkey's paw curls.
Where did you get that one?
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Allison Keyes.